quadrupled the output of components in a single day. The woman's warning that such profligate use would soon exhaust their supply was undoubtedly correct, but Lizanne argued the need to produce finished weapons outweighed any concerns about defense. "One thing I have learned, madam," she said. "In war, moderation is not a virtue, but an impediment." Using so much product so quickly also gave her the chance to fulfill her educational obligation, though Morva was a frequently recalcitrant student. After completing a shift at the forge, Lizanne had her assist with moving the molded components to the assembly line. The Verestian woman's first attempt had an entire row of workers ducking for cover when she propelled a crate full of components across the manufactory with all the force of a cannon shot.
"Only ever used it to throw things," she said,
with a shrug of what Lizanne discerned to be studied indifference.
"The O'Canis family needs a bloodblessed that can fight, not push things around like a glorified cart horse."
"I've seen you fight," Lizanne returned, "and you're no better a cart horse than you are a fighter." That earned a glaring sneer, Morva turning on her heel to stalk from the manufactory, then freezing in place as Lizanne's black closed around her. She held her still for a second, then slowly lifted her off the ground, turning her around and setting her down close to the stack of crated components. She could feel the woman struggling in her grip, lashing out with her own black in a series of undisciplined blasts that were too unfocused to have any effect. Lizanne maintained her grip until Morva exhausted her reserves, then released her after a final squeeze to empty her lungs.
"Athilda says you're not really an O'Canis,"
Lizanne said, moving to stand over Morva as she knelt, clutching her chest and gasping.
"Is that true?"
"That whore is no O'Canis either,"
Morva rasped, raising her gaze to glare at Lizanne.
"She says they bought you."
Lizanne went to her haunches, bringing her face level with Morva's.
"Why are you so loyal to a family that sees you as just a useful slave?"
Morva gritted her teeth and looked away.
"Uncle Alzar always told me I was free to go. Go, a lone child in the Red Tides. Where exactly would you go?" "You don't understand. The High Wall. It's my home."
A child taken from a life of bondage and abuse, given a home, told she had a family. Even if it was all just a contrivance to win her loyalty, clearly it worked.
"Your home will burn," Lizanne said, "along with everything else if we don't win this war. Make no mistake, I have seen the face of our enemy and it is all too real. This is the first battle."
She inclined her head at the busy lines of workers.
"Every minute spent here is another step to victory. Every bolt, screw, and lever we make is worth 1,000 bullets."
She took a fresh vial of black from the pocket of her overalls and held it out.
"Let's try again, shall we? Shift me 5 tons by the end of the day, and I'll show you how to shatter a kneecap with just a drop of black."
The first growler came off the production line a week later, followed by the first thumper 2 days after that. Jemiah had given manufacture of the smokers over to the small band of gunsmiths and armorers who had escaped Lossamark. Their progress was slow, and they shared a tendency to ignore entreaties to forsake long-ingrained perfectionism for speedy production. However, after another week of cajoling and a liberal ration of green to stave off fatigue, the gunsmith's workshop was producing the new carbines at a rate of 5 a day. With the assembly lines running at reasonable efficiency, Jemiah focused his efforts on ammunition, Lizanne and the other bloodblessed exhausting all but a small amount of their red to once again kickstart the process. The shell casings and projectiles were soon coming off the lines in decent quantities, but the propellant needed to fill them required a more prolonged and hazardous process.
"The Verestians only gave us black powder," Jemiah said. He had established a separate workshop to manufacture the ammunition, an old warehouse situated at a decent remove from the town. The mostly female workforce had been hand-picked for their dexterity, and many were former seamstresses or print setters. They all wore overalls fastened with laces rather than buttons, Jemiah having forbidden the smallest scrap of metal in the place.
"Works fine for cannon, but it'll foul the workings of the growlers and thumpers," he went on. "We need to add flakes of nitrate and grind it into a fine dust."
"As long as it works," Lizanne said. Watching his head sag a little as he nodded, she said,
"Get some sleep. You've done more than enough for now. This lot needs watching. Then send them home."
A faint smile formed on her lips as an idea occurred to her.
"Tomorrow will be a holiday," she said. "I think these people deserve a small celebration."
The smile slipped from her lips as she turned away, knowing that for many, whatever festivities she organized could well be the last they ever saw. Chapter 23. Clay. It was only thanks to the green in his veins that he was able to make out much of anything below the surface. The undulating lake bed stretched away beneath him, featureless but for a sand-covered hump almost directly below. He angled his body towards the hump and kicked with all the enhanced strength his body would allow. His objective became clearer as he descended, resolving into something vaguely boat-shaped. It was almost entirely covered by silt, but for one section near its narrow prow that appeared to have been scraped away. A gondola, he realized as he swam closer, the sight of a hatch resolving through the murk, an open hatch. An aerostat's gondola. Clay's lungs began to burn as he forced his body lower, coming to a thrashing halt a good 40 feet short. "Got too much air in me," he knew, as a renewed bout of kicking failed to push him any lower. He stopped moving, focusing his gaze on the half-open hatch and reaching out with Black. It took two hard tugs before the hatch came free, revealing something round and shiny in the gloom within. "Kriz," Clay thought, recognizing the helmet and using Black to draw her out of the gondola. His vision was already beginning to blur thanks to the lack of air and there was no time for finesse. Kriz's helmet thumped against the side of the hatchway as he dragged her clear, opening his arms to catch her as she shot upwards. She sagged in his grasp, limp and unmoving, but he could feel the faint beat of her heart as his hands pressed against her chest. Clay's hands fumbled at the weighted belt about her waist for a few agonizing seconds before it came free. He began to kick for the surface, when something fast and large streaked out of the gloom directly ahead, Clay having time to register the sight of two triangular rows of teeth before instinctively unleashing his Black. The green recoiled as if it had charged into a brick wall, blood seeping like crimson smoke from its nostrils as it twisted and vanished into the gloom, tail whipping. Clay twisted about, seeing a sleek, narrow shape cut through the murk a short distance away, quickly followed by another moving in the opposite direction. "They're circling," he realized, head swiveling left and right. His body spasmed then as the product in his veins started to thin in earnest, lungs now like fire, the greens coming closer with every circle. He knew with awful certainty the attack would come soon and all at once, the whole pack rending and tearing at the hated intruders in a frenzy. It was as if they knew his product was fading, and all they had to do was wait. Panic rising, he lashed out with Red at the closest drake, leaving a lightning fork-like trail of bubbles through the water. The green veered away, more in confusion than distress, as Clay could see no apparent damage to the beast. "Stupid," he thought, skin prickling in the suddenly warm water. "Boil them and you boil yourself." Which left only the Black,
and there were too many to push away. He convulsed again, clamping his mouth shut against his body's instinctive need to gasp. A strange, reflective calm overtook him then, the panic vanishing as the imminence of death became a certainty. A last serene notion slipped into his head as he felt Kriz begin to slip from his arms. Too many to push. Then don't push. Pull. Pull the water. Water. More substantial than air, which could be affected by black, but only in the most unfocused way. Water was different. Water could be pulled. Clay used the last vestiges of his reason to marshal his black, focusing his attention on the space separating them from the drakes, then expending it all at once to draw the water towards them. The effect was immediate and dramatic, the pressure of so much water compressing at once, shooting the pair of them to the surface. They broke through into a cacophony of sound and beautiful, sweet-tasting air. Clay heard his uncle call out before they plunged down. He kicked for the surface and dragged more air into his lungs as they bobbed back up. He could see the raft a little over 10 yards away, which suddenly seemed a great distance in light of what lurked beneath. Uncle Braddon and Preacher were both kneeling, rifles pointed in his direction, whilst Cigarol stood to the side, tipping a vial of product down his throat. Clay began to call out for a rope, but the yell died as Cigarol cast the vial aside and focused his gaze. Clay felt the invisible hand of black close around him, and a heartbeat later, he and Kriz were being dragged through the water at a considerable rate of knots. Braddon and Preacher fired several shots in the time it took for them to reach the raft, Cigarol lifting them clear of the lake at the last instant to deposit them in the center of the raft. Clay was forced to spend some time gasping for breath before he began to get the helmet off Kriz's head.
"I got it,"
Braddon said, crouching to pull the helmet clear, revealing Kriz's slack, unresponsive features. Braddon held a hand to her mouth then, muttering a curse, lay her flat on her back, and delivered several hard shoves to her sternum with both hands. Clay's gaze was dragged away by a sudden commotion, turning to see a green frozen in mid-leap close to the edge of the raft. Cigarol held the beast in place long enough to aim his carbine and put a bullet through its skull. The lieutenant cast the green's corpse away, and Clay turned back, watching his uncle pumping Kriz's chest.
"Must have had some air left in the helmet,"
Clay said, knowing it was a desperate notion.
"I felt her heartbeat, uncle."
Braddon said nothing, continuing his rhythmic shoves, Kriz's head lolling in response with not even a flicker to her eyelids. He kept at it until Preacher's rifle fell silent a minute or so later. Braddon sat back on his haunches, turning to Clay with a grim shake of his head.
"Aye."
All four of them started as Kriz jerked, a gout of water erupting from her mouth. She spent some time convulsing, breath coming in deep, sore-like rasps, eventually choking into a bout of violent coughing. Clay moved to clasp her hand as she continued to cough, finding it closed into a tight fist.
I found them,
she said, when the coughing had subsided, meeting Clay's gaze with a bright smile. She opened her fist to reveal two objects. One was a small crystal shard, little bigger than an arrowhead, and the other a glass vial. Clay initially took it for product, but the color was strange, possessed of a rainbow-like sheen as it caught the light.
"What are they?"
he asked. Kriz's smile broadened, and she reached out with her other hand to caress his face.
"The keys to convergence. Seems we came an awful long way for such small things."
Lauriabeth peered at the two objects in Kriz's palm with a dubious gaze.
"Density is relative and often deceptive,"
Kriz replied.
"Everything you can see or touch is made up of mostly empty space."
She sat huddled close to the campfire, a blanket about her shoulders. They had retreated a good distance from the lake shore before making camp, Chris having to be carried most of the way. She had shivered continually during the trip, and even now spoke with a pronounced tremor to her voice.
"I need black," she said, looking at Clay.
He frowned, concerned by her wan face and red, overbright eyes.
"You don't want to wait a while?"
"Black."
She held out her free hand, continuing in her own language.
"As you know, I have waited a very long time for this, and find myself out of patience."
Clay duly handed over a vial of black, Chris drinking a quarter of the contents before focusing her gaze on the crystal sitting in her palm. It floated free and drifted away from her, then seemed to shimmer as it began to vibrate, Clay detecting a familiar tinkling sound he had last heard in their trance in the hidden enclave. The rest of the company let out a mingling of gasps and surprised profanity as the crystal abruptly unfolded. Narrow spikes lanced out from the core, catching the firelight as it spun under Chris's manipulation, eventually slowing to hang serenely in the air, resembling a star in the way it glittered. Clay stepped closer to it, memory racing with recognition. The trance in which Chris had shown him the cavern where Zembi had created the first white, the four crystals, red, green, blue, and one so dark it seemed to swallow the light.
"The black crystal," he said, reaching out to press a tentative finger to one of the spikes. "We actually, Seer Dan, found it."
"Kinda begs the question of what we do with it," Braddon said, moving closer to peer at the crystal.
"It will enable communication," Chris said, "between Drake and human, specifically black drakes and humans."
"Clay can already do that," Skaggerhill said.
"Only with Lutheran," Clay said. "And that was thanks to Miss Eflin. If he'd stayed with us any longer, things would have gone bad sooner or later, for us and him."
He turned to Chris. "We can command them with this, right? Make them join us." She shook her head.
"Of all the purebred species, the blacks were always the hardest to control. More intelligent than the others and more aggressive towards humans. This was partially why Father was never able to successfully crossbreed them. The white contains bloodlines from all Drake species, except the black."
"Guess that's why they didn't join its war," Clay said. "And why they fought him when he rose before. Fought alongside the people who lived here to bring him down."
"That I can't explain," Chris replied. "It's clear that the world my people built fell, and the civilization that grew in its place was able to achieve some kind of symbiosis with the Drakes."
"Heartblood."
Clay remembered the mosaic from the hidden city that lay on the far side of the lake. "Their queen would drink heartblood and bond with a black. That's what bound them together. With this," he nodded at the crystal, "we won't have to." He heard his uncle let out a faint groan, and turned to find him frowning in grim realization.
"Captain?" Skaggerhill asked. "He means we're gonna have to go find us some blacks," Braddon said. "To make friends with."
"That's what you need?"
Clay asked later, nodding at the glass vial in Chris's hand. The others were all sleeping, Clay and Chris having taken the first watch. She had returned the black crystal to its original state, and now sat regarding the vial in one hand, and the blade-shaped shard in the other.
"You drink that, and you can unlock the memories Zembi put in there," he went on.
"Yes,"
she said, her eyes tracking from the shard to the vial, but making no move to drink it.
"Is it dangerous?"
he asked, sensing her reluctance and switching to her language.
"All knowledge is dangerous, but all knowledge is precious. the contradiction at the heart of everything the Philos caste studied or created.
Convergence, Clay said.
What is it?
Chris was silent for a time, turning the vial over in her fingers, face rapt.
Does this look like Drake blood to you?
She asked, holding the vial out to him. He took it, holding it up so the firelight illuminated the contents.
Kinda, he said, handing it back.
Looks a little like one of the more expensive iron ship dilutions. Color's different, though.
Then it might surprise you to know that no part of what is in this vial came from a drake, except the knowledge of how to make it. This is what your people call product clay. It will do everything blue will do, but it was not siphoned from the corpse of some unfortunate beast. It was made. Zembi believed that the abilities of the Bloodblessed lay dormant in all of us. What else could explain the random nature of the blessing? If only a small proportion of the population developed the ability during early adolescence, an ability they clearly didn't inherit, then the same potential rested in all of us. If the right formula could be found, it could unlock that potential. Think of it, Clay. A whole world of people able to share their thoughts, craft wonders, walk this earth without fear. This is what we were working for all those years under the ice. This is the key to convergence. This,
she held up the vial once more,
is synthetic product. Anyone can drink it and harness the power it holds. Not just the blessed. Anyone.
The white, Clay said. You needed it to make this. She lowered her gaze, Clay seeing a mirror of the shame he had seen on the face of her younger self in the trance.
It's unfair of me to despise you so,
she had told the sickly white as it glared at her from the pit.
Like you, it appears I should never have been born.
There is more than just Drake blood in the white, she said.
It took him a moment to realize the import of what she had said, a chilly fist closing around his heart as the implications struck home.
People, he said in a slow, hard rasp. You use people to make that thing.
Not people. Human tissue. Mostly unfertilized eggs and plasma. Zembi had developed a method of blending organic material at the microscopic level. Another barely understood gift from the crystals. It took years. There were many failures.
Chris's head lowered farther still, voice dropping to nearly a whisper.
Many. Things were brought into this world. Things we are fortunate did not live for more than a few minutes after hatching. Then came the first white, and Zembi thought he had his discovery. The ultimate triumph of the Philos caste. Its blood was unique, much easier to study than the other breeds. It gave us clues as to how to formulate synthetic compounds. Clues we would never have had if it hadn't been born.
But it got out. While you slept, it got out.
Turned him into a spoiled and somehow made it to a razzia.
All knowledge is dangerous. All knowledge is precious.
Chris looked again at the shard in her hand.
At least now we have a chance to discover how it got out.
Could be he only had that thing because the white allowed it. Maybe it wanted him to give it to you.
For all we know, you'll drop down dead the moment you enter the trance. Chris jerked her chin at Preacher's sleeping form on the other side of the campfire.
Your friend gave us a lesson in faith the other day. Maybe it's one we should heed.
Faithful he surely is, but he's also crazy.
Clay reached out, placing his hand over hers to cover the vial in the shard.
Don't. At least not here, not now. Wait till we're back on the ship, or at least somewhere that could be called civilized. We got what we came for.
She gave a small grin, slipping back into her accented Mandalorian to ask,
that an order, Captain?
If you like. We got a long way to go, and a better chance of surviving this trip with 3 blood-blessed instead of 2. She gently pushed his hand away and looked again at the items in her hand, before nodding and consigning them to the pocket of her jacket.
As you wish. I wouldn't want anyone calling me a mutineer.
In the morning, he woke in time for his trance with Zenita Okanis, spending several minutes in contemplation of the vial in his hand. It did happen, he thought, replaying the events at the lake in his head. I tranced without drinking. But how? There was only one explanation that made any sense. Heart blood. He had been able to maintain a mental connection with Jack from the moment he drank blue heart blood. And what else could that be called but a kind of trance? If he could trance with a drake, why not a human? Checking his watch to confirm the moment had arrived, he shrugged and returned the blue vial to his wallet. One way to find out. Closing his eyes, he concentrated on Zenita's face, reasoning it would summon enough memories of her to establish the connection. Nothing happened. He tried to recall every interaction with the Verestian woman, discovering they were few in number. Just enough, in fact, to forge enough of a connection for the blue-facilitated trance. Looks like I need something more for this one, he decided, pondering that moment on the raft again. The trance with Chris had seemed to occur naturally, without any conscious decision, as if his fear for her had reached down to the bottom of the lake and forced its way into her mind. Fear. Fear is an emotion. When they first met, Lizanne had tutored him on the basics of the trance, explaining that mental communication required some form of emotional connection between the two parties. It's how we remember one another in the real world, she said. Not through faces, but feelings, however slight. Think of all the people you must have met in your life. Now ask yourself how many you remember. Comparatively few, I imagine. You remember those who made you laugh, those who made you cry, and, especially in your case, Mr. Tallcreek, apparently those who made you angry most of all. Anger. Another emotion. Zenita had never made him angry, nor had she made him laugh, except during those times she directed her occasionally caustic observations at Captain Heilmore. An image blossomed in his mind then. Heilmore's face, rendered in much more detail than Clay could have recalled. The captain, it transpired, had a small mole on his chin Clay had never noticed. But she did, he realized. This ain't my memory. It's hers. Heilmore's our connection. He summoned his much more plentiful supply of Heilmore-related memories, all shot through with the conflicting range of emotions the captain always birthed in him, from grudging admiration to consternation to, most of all, anger. Zenita's mindscape arrived with disorienting swiftness. The jewel-encrusted ship filling his vision in a flash, and Clay stumbling as he felt its boards beneath his boots. He let out a delighted laugh at the sight of Zenita herself, standing near the prow, and regarding him with a half-baffled, half-amused expression.
Are you all right? She asked. The captain will be dismayed to discover the interior has driven you mad.
We wouldn't want that, Clay replied.
I know how you'd hate to disappoint him, and all.
Zenita's expression hardened into something that reminded Clay this was a very dangerous woman if the mood took her. And this was her mind.
Just a bad joke, he said, raising his hands. I got some interesting news to share, if you're ready.
The Karnstadt Mountains, Braddon said. Club finger tapping the map.
The mountains lay southwest of the Torquils, a considerable distance from their current location.
That's an awful long way, Uncle, Clay pointed out. You want blacks. That's where you'll find them. Largest concentration anywhere on the continent. There are pockets in the copper soils and the crack mines on the far western coast, but this is the only place you're guaranteed a black kill.
Except we ain't going to kill them,
Laurie Beth put in.
We're going to make nice and ask them to join up to fight the white, if and you can believe it. Not sure I do, so the seer's ass knows what they'll think of it.
Seeing Preacher stiffen at the blasphemy, she added,
Sorry,
in a low mumble.
They're a rambunctious lot, to be sure, Skaggahill said. Blacks grow big and mean in those mountains. Cunning, too. Long Rifles took a pass through the foothills a few years back. Lost a marksman and a gun hand with only 2 kills to show for it.
Still a profitable trip by my recollection, Braddon said, a faint note of annoyance in his voice.
Good news is, he continued, turning back to Clay, we don't have no spoil to worry about twixt here and there. Just a whole lot of Serath wrangling and walking in between.
He lowered his voice to add,
Skaggs is right, though. Next to the Red Sands, it's just about the worst country I ever contracted in. I'd hoped never to set eyes on the place again.
Clay looked at the map. The distance was dismaying, but if they were to make this expedition count for something, he couldn't see any other option.
I tranced with Captain O'Canis this morning, he said. The Superior's making for Stockholm.
He tapped the dot 100 miles or so south of the Kronstadts.
So we have to get there, and the route leads us past the mountains in any case.
He clapped his uncle's shoulder and moved away, eyes roaming the surrounding plain.
Looks like we got some mounts to find.
Lieutenant, I believe it's your turn to tame the bull. Chapter 24 Pylemore. Pylemore tracked his spyglass over the bodies hanging from the Stockholm harbor wall, counting 20 in all. Curiously, the row of suspended corpses was confined to the right-hand side of the wall, halting at the huge copper and wood edifice of the harbor door. Each corpse had a noose around its neck, and some kind of sign fixed to its chest, but the distance was too great to make out any words. I doubt it's a welcome in any case, he decided, lowering the glass and nodding to Talmant.
Ahead dead slow, Lieutenant.
Ahead dead slow. Aye, sir.
Pylemore had ordered the Superior to battle stations upon commencing their approach to the port, although the truce pennant fluttered from her mast and her signal lamp flashed a repeated request for safe harbor. So far, however, no one had appeared atop the harbor wall to issue either a welcome or a warning. Stockholm's wall was unusual in that it was more of a dam than a single barrier against the tide. It curved out from the steep slopes forming the apex of the channel where the port lay. It was famed for the unique geographical feature of a waterfall that cascaded into a lake at the base of a huge crater within which the port had grown. The lake was kept at a constant depth by a series of huge outlet tunnels. Consequently, the waters around the wall were in a permanent state of frothy turmoil, save for a narrow stretch of calm water directly in front of the door. This ensured a nervous approach, as any evasive maneuvers the Superior might make would see her floundering in the churn.
All stop!
Pylemore ordered as the door loomed larger. He was close enough now to read the signs adorning the hanging bodies, finding them each bearing the same message, painted in red Mandalorian letters. Corporate murderer.
Perhaps coming here wasn't the best idea, Pylemore concluded.
He was about to order Talmant to signal the engine room to reverse the propeller, drawing them away in preparation for turning about, when the harbor door let out a loud squeal of grinding metal and began to ascend.
Pretty sight, ain't it, Skipper?
Scrimshine commented as the port was revealed. The famous Stockholm Falls cascaded from atop a tall, narrow promontory
extending from the crater wall. The falls birthed a plume of misty vapor as it met the lake below, producing a small rainbow as it caught the sun. This pleasing spectacle was contrasted by the sight of the town itself. It stretched away on either side of the falls, covering the banks of the lake and ascending up the steep flanks of the crater. Denied building space, the residents of Stockholm had built up rather than out, the place featuring some of the tallest buildings Heilmor had seen, some rising 6 stories or more. The architecture varied in style, from high-angled roofed colonial mansions to Corventine-influenced official buildings, complete with classical pillars and statuary. The taller structures all conformed to modern standards, reflecting the clean, uncluttered lines favored by the corporate world. This would all have made for an aesthetically varied and interesting view, if Heilmor's practiced eye hadn't noticed the signature signs of cannon shot on many walls, accompanied by the blackening and vanished roofs that told of extensive burning. The damage was worse close to the docks, where many buildings had been completely burned out and others reduced to rubble. Heilmor's initial assumption that the port had been attacked in much the same manner as Carvenport was proven mistaken as he took in the sight of the numerous flags flying over the buildings on either side of the falls. The flags on the western side were all the black square emblazoned with a silver ship pennant of the South Seas Maritime Company, whilst those on the eastern side consisted of a simpler design, white with an uneven red X within a square. Thanks to his prior engagement, Heilmor was fairly familiar with the symbol, and was obliged to contain a dismayed groan at the sight of it.
"Buggers have been fighting each other, Skipper," Scrimshine observed.
Even with his newfound regard for military manners, he still had difficulty in restraining his tongue.
"Don't recognize that flag, though. One of those new East Mandanorian syndicates, maybe?"
"It's not a company flag," Heilmor said. "It appears the Voters' Rights Alliance has a significant presence here." He could see numerous vessels in the harbor, none of them warships. Only one was in motion, an old blue hunter Heilmor soon recognized. The Farlight's signal lamp blinked out a message as she approached, moving at dead slow and drifting to a halt some 50 yards short of the door.
"Half the town, V, pleased to see you," Talmont related the message. "Steer to port or the other half will fire on you."
Heilmor was tempted to follow his first impulse to turn the Superior about and make for open water. This place was clearly riven with internal strife, and he had no desire to embroil his command in a conflict that might impede their mission. But the Superior was down to less than 1/5 of her coal reserves. Added to that was their rapidly diminishing food stocks, and all the ammunition they had expended in the Torquils. Without a substantial resupply, the chances of recovering the long rifles and making use of their discovery were slight at best.
"Ahead dead slow," Heilmor told Talmont. "Mr. Scrimshine, take her in and steer immediately to port."
Ethany Colvetch.
The young woman in the ill-fitting and besmirched uniform greeted Heilmor with a salute.
"Acting Colonel, South Seas Maritime Defense and Security Force."
Given her youth and diminutive size, Heilmor might have found Colvetch's appearance almost comical, but for the recently stitched cut above her left eye and the carbine slung over her shoulder. The fact that she had the weapon slung barrel down and wore a half-empty bandolier across her chest indicated she had plenty of practice in using it. She had been waiting on the quayside along with a squad of similarly disheveled but well-armed South Seas Maritime Marines. He took note of the way her gaze continually strayed to the eastern regions of the port across the harbor, as if expecting a cannon shell to come sailing over at any second.
"Corrick Heilmor," he replied with a salute of his own. "Captain of the IPV Superior."
"Welcome, Captain.
Captain Tidlow of the Farlight vouched for your conduct, but was somewhat reluctant to elaborate as to your mission here.
Resupply. Assuming South Seas Maritime is still open for business.
Kolvetch's gaze darkened with disappointment.
I had hoped you might have been subcontracted to assist us in our local difficulty. We tranced requests for reinforcement with head office until our bloodblessed fell victim to a sniper's bullet. That was 2 weeks ago.
Sadly, I knew nothing of the situation here until we caught sight of your wall. Unfortunate business.
The colonel's eyes grew darker still as she settled her gaze on the eastern districts.
They hung all our senior managers on the first day of their so-called uprising, held a trial and so on, to give it the appearance of actual justice.
The signs proclaim them as murderers.
There had been a good deal of trouble since the other ports went silent, and ships started arriving with all manner of mad rumors. Management's attempts to quell the disorder may have been excessive, but they certainly didn't deserve to be slaughtered at the hands of a slum-born mob.
A shudder ran through Kolvetch then, and she lowered her gaze, while more realizing she was even younger than she first appeared.
Forgive me, she said, straightening her back. My father was amongst the slain. He had command of defense and security here.
I see. My condolences. And your position in this port, Colonel?
When the uprising began, I was a junior executive in the Customs Enforcement Division. 2 days later, I was the most senior official left. It took some hard fighting, but with good and loyal soldiers,
she inclined her head at the squad of Marines,
and the support of the corporate populace, we won back half the city.
Would I be correct in assuming, therefore, that you are the only figure in authority on this side of the harbor?
You would. If you wish to purchase supplies, you will negotiate with me. As a corporate officer, I'm sure you'll understand that prices will reflect prevailing circumstances.
Almore's hand went to his breast pocket and emerged with a gold Dalsian sovereign, one of the stack taken from the wreck of the Wind Queen. Pilemore had fortuitously liberated the coins and other sundry valuables from the viable opportunity safe before seizing the Superior.
I'm sure we can agree on a mutually beneficial price, he said, handing over the coin.
Kolvetch glanced at the sovereign, betraying scant interest before handing it back.
You mistake me, Captain, she said. It is not money I require, but your service. Vile insurrection has sundered this port in two. I require your assistance in uniting it. And,
she fixed him with a steely, implacable gaze, voice taking on a hungry tremor,
ensuring justice is meted out to every last voter bastard we can lay our hands on. It's been a stalemate for the better part of a month.
Kolvetch had escorted him to the roof of South Seas Maritime Headquarters in Stockholm, the tallest structure in the port, affording a fine view of the whole city.
As you can see, the falls create a natural and impassable barrier between the eastern and western districts, meaning the only avenues of advance are via the harbor or the wall. The voters attempted a charge across the wall the day after we secured control of this side. A few mass rifle volleys were enough to see them off. They tried a night attack in boats next. Fortunately, most of the ships in the harbor chose to ally with us, and they didn't even make it to the wharf. Since then, they've been content to stay in their hovels and cast the occasional shell at us.
They have artillery, then? Almore asked.
Two batteries of 6-pounders and one 18-pounder long-barreled cannon, whilst we have only 4 heavy guns. That's the main reason I haven't yet ordered an attack of our own, plus lack of numbers. All told, I have less than 300 soldiers under arms, plus just over 700 volunteers from the townsfolk. They're low on training and weapons, but keen as a blade.
The voter numbers?
The neighborhoods east of the falls are more populous than on our side. Plenty of slum rats over there to recruit to their deluded cause. I'd estimate at least 3,000 under arms.
Almore let out a sigh of grim amusement.
I have faced long odds before, Colonel, but never impossible ones. What exactly do you expect a single warship to do against such numerous shore-based opposition?
Destroy that damn artillery of theirs,
Kolvetch returned, her tone heating appreciably.
She pulled a folded map from the pocket of her tunic and began to unfurl it.
Through careful observation, we have pinpointed most of their guns.
No.
She fell silent, clearly taken aback by the flat, uncompromising tone of his refusal.
This plan is sound.
Colonel!
Heilmore's voice was pitched just below a shout, and he took a moment to calm his rising frustration before continuing.
Do you have any notion of what is happening in the rest of the world?
She stared at him, confusion and anger adding a red tinge to her face.
Some kind of emergency, she said. Drakes and spoiled running amok. Once the combined might of the corporate world is brought to bear on the savages and beasts...
Carvenport has fallen to those savages and beasts,
Aylmore broke in.
Mooresvale has fallen, Pharos has fallen, and I dare say other cities have since shared their fate. The might of the corporate world has already been brought to bear and found wanting. And while the world burns, this city tears itself apart without a Drake in sight. I'll have no part of your petty war, and if you are unwilling to sell me supplies, perhaps your friends across the water will be more amenable.
Kolvetch's face twisted into a snarl, her hands twitching, and Halmore knew she was resisting the impulse to reach for her carbine.
You would treat with those scum.
To fulfill my mission, I would treat with all the demons of the travail.
Aylmore stood to attention and spoke in formal tones.
I am impressed with your achievements here, but you have no hope of victory. I am willing to mediate.
Piss on your mediation!
Kolvetch's nostrils flared as she glared at him, breath becoming ragged in her fury.
I should shoot you!
Then you'll have my ship's guns to contend with alongside the voters' artillery.
Heilmore gave a salute, which she failed to return, and started towards the stairwell. Instead of a single authority figure, the voters presented him with a committee of six. Heilmore was depressed to find them all much the same age as Colonel Kolvetch, with a similarly steely look in their eyes, which told him he was in for a very taxing meeting. He had made his way to the eastern docks in the ship's launch, standing at the prow with the truce flag in hand. He found the wharf abandoned, though the flicker of movement behind the windows of the surrounding houses indicated his arrival had been noticed. After an interval of several minutes, a lone, stocky young man in a contractor's duster emerged from a shadowed alley with a revolver in hand. On the sleeve of his duster was an armband bearing the cross and square emblem of the Voters' Rights Alliance. The young man lurked in a crouch at the corner of the alley, wary eyes tracking from Heilmore to the western side of the city. After some further scrutiny, he pointed to the launch, scowling at Heilmore.
"Send them back," he said.
Aylmore nodded and called out an order for the launch to return to the ship. The crew were clearly reluctant to leave him in such uncertain company, but dutifully dipped their oars and began to row away.
"Come here,"
the stocky man said, gesturing with his revolver before disappearing back into the alley. Aylmore followed him through a short maze of cramped streets until he rounded a corner, to find himself confronted by a dozen or so young men and women, all leveling firearms at him.
"Search him,"
the man in the duster ordered. Heilmore was then subjected to a few minutes' rough handling at the hands of a trio of rebels, which came to an abrupt end when he jabbed his elbow into the face of a skinny youth who tried to take his pocket watch.
"Are you voters or thieves?"
he asked as they tensed around him.
"Corporate bastard,"
the skinny youth said, lying on the cobbles and clutching a broken nose.
"Shoot him, Cole!"
"Shut it,"
the Dusterclap man said.
"Freeman Tal's got unfortunate habits,"
he told Heilmore.
"Comes from growing up living off the scraps allowed us by corporate slavers."
Heilmore brushed the blood from the sleeve of his tunic and said nothing.
"I'm Freeman Cole, and this is the Wash Lane Defense Volunteers,"
the young man said, gesturing to the other youths.
"Don't mistake us, Mr. Protectorate Man. You don't get a second chance."
He slowly lowered his revolver and jerked his head to the left.
"This way. Tal, you're on guard duty tonight. Told you before about thieving."
Cole led Heilmore to a cobbled square formed by the intersection of several streets. Sitting in the center of the square was an inn of such antique, slant-walled appearance that Heilmore concluded it must have stood there since the earliest days of the city. An armed guard pulled the door open as they approached, Heilmore following Cole into the gloomy, candlelit interior. After squinting for several seconds to adjust his sight, Heilmore saw Cole taking a seat at a long table alongside five other people of similar age. There were two men besides Cole and three women, all staring at Heilmore in expectant silence. The inn was clearly a headquarters of some kind. Maps and documents littered the tables, and the walls were covered in leaflets and radical propaganda, including, Heilmore was both amused and dismayed to see, numerous pages from the Voters' Gazette. Seeing little need to stand on ceremony, he took a stool from one of the tables, dragging it across the tiled floor to sit down.
"Lieutenant Corrick Heilmore," he introduced himself. "Commander of the Iron Ship Protectorate Vessel Superior. Might I know to whom I am speaking?"
"Free men and free women,"
one of the six replied. A girl of about 19 by Heilmore's reckoning. From the sunken state of her eyes and sallow skin, she appeared not to have slept for several days. Despite her fatigue, the defiance in her voice and bearing was palpable as she added,
"Who will not be cowed by corporate threats?"
"I haven't made any threats," Heilmore pointed out.
"How many ships in your fleet?"
another of the six demanded, a red-haired and freckle-faced lad with a bandage covering one ear.
"My fleet?" Heilmore inquired.
"Don't play with us," Cole growled. "We know Iron Ship's been hired to retake this place for South Seas Maritime."
"Then you know more than I do," Heilmore told him. "I have no fleet. For that matter, the Iron Ship Syndicate no longer has a fleet. Not in these waters, at least."
"South Seas Maritime agents met in Sonora with the Interim Iron Ship Board 3 weeks ago,"
the hollow-eyed girl said.
"You presume to tell us you are not here as a result."
Heilmore gave no immediate reply, gaze narrowing as it tracked over each of them. So young and guileless despite all the blood they've spilled.
"So you're in trance communication with Sonora," he said.
This heralded a silence during which the girl lowered her head as her red-haired colleague shot her a glare of reproach.
"I have had no contact with Iron Ship senior management for quite some time now," Heilmore went on. "My ship is here on business unconnected with your insurrection. I wish to purchase supplies and I have gold to pay for it. That is all."
"He's lying,"
the red-haired youth rasped.
"Corporatists lie. It's what they do. Remember Red Loman's Day."
Another silence as they exchanged glances, both fierce and uncertain.
"Red Loman's Day?"
Heilmore asked.
The spark that lit the tinder, Cole replied. Colonel Kolvetch, the first one, invited our leaders to a meeting. He told them their concerns would be addressed, told them a new government would be established for this port, a joint government, he said. When they turned up, he had them stripped naked, flogged, paraded through the streets, then shot in the head. He gave a thin smile. Hung the bastard myself from the wall and laughed as he dangled and kicked. Looked a little like the clown from that circus marionette show they put on for the kiddies. So you see, his smile faded as he reclined in his seat. We ain't too trusting of corporate types these days. Aylmore nodded and rose from his stool. He went to the wall, scanning the many pages pinned to it, until he found something familiar and ripped it free. The shared guilt of the corporate age, he read aloud. How the greed and corruption of the modern economy shames us all. He moved to the table, placing the page in front of Cole. By Luella Tithencroft, acting editor of the Voters' Gazette. I was actually in her office when she wrote this. He grimaced, puffing out a small regretful sigh. We had quite the argument about it, as I recall.
You know Luella Tithencroft?
The hollow-eyed girl asked, gaze narrowed in doubt. I should, Aylmore replied. We were engaged to be married until very recently. The hollow-eyed girl's name was Gillette, and it transpired that she was the only blood-blessed left in Stockholm. After Heilmore's revelation, the committee had him escorted outside, before spending the next hour in discussion, some of it quite heated, judging by the shouts emerging from the inn. Eventually, the voices fell silent, and Heilmore was obliged to spend another hour wandering the square, closely watched by the Wash Lane Defense volunteers.
You been in battles, then?
One of them asked, a hefty boy no more than 16 years old, who seemed intrigued by the medal ribbons on Heilmore's tunic.
I have, he replied.
Who with?
Dalcians, pirates, Corventines, and, most recently, Drakes.
The boy's features bunched in surprise.
So it's true, then? They've risen up like the seer said.
I'm not sure the seer foresaw all of this, but yes, the Drakes are now making war on us, with the help of the spoiled.
How come they ain't come for us, then?
Aylmore cast a gaze at the sky and the surrounding cliffs. The lip of the enclosing crater was crowned with a series of defensive forts joined by a wall. To Heilmore's eyes, it seemed too insubstantial and dilapidated to offer much defense in the event of a serious attack.
I don't know, he replied, but I'm sure they'll get to it eventually.
You're wanted,
Cole called from the inn's doorway.
Your first ship,
Gillette said once Heilmore had made his way back inside. She stood reading from a sheet of paper, suspicion still evident in her face.
The IPV Company Pride, Aylmore replied.
Your youngest brother's name and occupation?
Starek. He's a schoolmaster.
Where and when did you first meet Luella Tithencroft?
During a riot in Sonora 4 years ago.
Her dog's name?
She's never had a dog, preferring cats. Her last cat, Mr. Muesli, died shortly before I left for Dalcia. He was very old.
Gillette lowered the sheet and nodded to Cole.
It's him.
Couldn't they just have shown you a photostat?
Aylmore asked. Gillette's lips formed a faint smile.
Apparently Free Woman Tithencroft advised our blood-blessed contact that she no longer possesses any photostats of you.
I see, Aylmore coughed. I assume, nevertheless, that she also advised that my word can be trusted.
No, she didn't. Not yet, anyway.
Gillette pointed to a table,
for a stack of blank paper sheets had been placed alongside a pen and inkwell.
Free Woman Tithoncroft insists on a full report of your activities and whereabouts for the past year. You will write it. I will memorize it.